This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later this hour, how are you doing on your summer to-do list? Have you been putting things off? I have. We'll find out why we procrastinate and get some advice on getting things done.
First, it's been almost a week since the first Republican primary debate, and enough polls are out there now to get a sense of who the biggest winners and losers were, according to Republican voters.
It's our weekly look at the latest in national politics. Also this week, Black Lives Matter protesters have been showing up at Democratic candidates' events, especially for Bernie Sanders. They interrupted one of his rallies in Seattle this past weekend. We'll take a look at why they're targeting him.
Here with us now is Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week at this time. Hey, Harry.
Hey, how you doing?
Well, doing pretty well, thanks. Now, looking back at the debate about a week ago, just about everybody jumped right in there to declare the winners and losers for that first debate. You hung back. You played it cool. You waited a few days, looked at the polls as they piled up to see who won and lost in public opinion. First of all, why did you wait?
Because debates and who wins them is as much about the media reaction and how the media plays it than voters' initial reactions. If you remember back in 2000, Gore actually was thought of as the winner by most voters after his first debate with George W. Bush. But the media and SNL, Saturday Night Live, got all over him, and the perception of voters began to shift as the further we got out from the debate. And, of course, it's well after the debate that it actually matters what voters think, not what they think initially.
So you've got a whole passel of polls that you looked at, so we're not drawing from just one. So what does that tell you about who people thought did well and not so much for other people?
Sure. The clear winner from this debate was Carly Fiorina, which, of course, is very funny because she wasn't actually part of the prime time debate, the one that started at 9 p.m. She was in what we were calling the junior varsity debate at 5 p.m., but she was able to break through. She had very nice statements to make. She was short. She was crisp. She was perfect for a soundbite. And she just stood above the field at 5 p.m. And if you look at where she was and asked voters who you thought won the debates overall, she even beat people at the 9 p.m. hour. People were talking about her well into the evening and the days afterward. And what we see in the post-debate polls is that she gained on average 6 percentage points, which is far more than anybody else gained. Marco Rubio and Ben Carson, who were in second, only gained on average 2.4 percentage points. So she was far and away the clear winner most people thought she won, and the polls reflect that.
Well, it's an interesting case because she wasn't in that pack of top-tier candidates. She was in the second-tier candidates on at the earlier time slot. Do you think the result would have been the same if she would have been debating the primetime group of people?
I get a feeling we're going to find out if it would have been the same in a month when CNN has its debate, because if she comes anywhere close to holding to the polling number she has now, she'll make it into there. But I think, of course, we grade on a curve. We judge relative to other candidates. And if you look at that 5 p.m. debate, no one was really impressive on that stage besides her, versus I think most people would agree at that 9 p.m. debate, there were a number of people who came across strongly, such as Marco Rubio, such as Ben Carson, and even the people who were sort of weaker, like a Chris Christie or a Rand Paul, certainly put in debate performances that were far and above better than most of the participants in the 5 p.m. debate.
And as far as the people who came out looking less than stellar, people who dropped a little in the polls, who stuck out to you?
It's very clear who the loser was. It's Wisconsin's governor, Scott Walker. He lost ground in every single post-debate poll. He lost on average 4.6 percentage points. A CNN poll that was taken in Iowa that just came out in the past few minutes has him dropping to third place. Remember, it was no more than a month ago, in fact, only probably a few weeks ago, that Walker was the leader and was in Iowa, and he had been leading there for months, at least since February, and now he's dropped all the way to third there and has dropped across the board in New Hampshire as well and nationally. Clearly, voters were just not impressed with what they saw from him on Thursday night.
Well, it's interesting because immediately after the debate, when we talked about Scott Walker's performance, it was that he didn't talk a lot, he didn't use all of his time, but he didn't alienate a lot of people either. So what happened between then and now?
I think what happened was, number one, people spoke so highly of, you know, Fiorina, and Trump, of course, always takes up a ton of media attention. But I think what this really tells us is how flexible voter choices are. Walker has always been well-liked among most Republicans, and that's still the case. He didn't disqualify himself. If you look at his favorable ratings, they're still quite high. But what happened was voters were introduced to alternatives, conservative alternatives, such as Carly Fiorina, and they said, well, you know what, we have some alternatives out there. We're going to at least for now cast our lot with them, and we'll see where we are in a few weeks. But this is more about other candidates picking up name recognition than it probably is anything that Walker did that was particularly poor.
And what about that Trump factor? Obviously, he was a big marquee name going into the debate. Fox News had some questions that were targeting him in terms of whether or not he was going to have a third-party run or not, whether he would rule it out. How did that play out in the debate?
Well, I think most voters, if you look at the polls, most voters did not feel that Trump was the ultimate winner. People either put Fiorina, even though she was in the 5 p.m., someone like Rubio, Cruz, or Marco Rubio, or Ben Carson as the winner. But Trump really didn't seem to hurt himself all that much. If you look at the polls, yes, he lost ground on average, but it sort of split. Some of the polls had him gaining, some of them had him losing. And remember, Trump is still the most well-known of these Republican candidates, and people who aren't paying that close attention to the race tend to gravitate towards the candidate who they know the best, and Trump is that person. So Trump is still leading in most of these contests. He was leading in a poll out from New Hampshire yesterday. He's leading in all of the post-debate Iowa polls. So he's still out in front, even if he is a little bit damaged.
We're talking to Harry Enten right now, senior political writer and analyst for 538. We're getting the latest in national politics right now. And this week, after the debate, there was this flap with Megyn Kelly and Donald Trump. Donald Trump saying the debate wasn't fair, making kind of incendiary comments that got a lot of people pretty upset in different camps, both sides there. Did that hurt his standing?
Well, I think one of the things that we are beginning to see in these post-debate polls, and you saw it a little bit in the pre-debate polls as well, is that there's becoming a gender gap with Trump support. So it had been previous that Trump was basically doing evenly well across the board. This is somewhat surprising if you think of Trump as sort of a Tea Party supporter, but he was doing well with Tea Party supporters, people who didn't support the Tea Party, very conservatives, non-very conservatives, and he was doing the same with men and women. But what we see now is that Trump support among men is at least 5 points higher than it is among women. And I don't think that's by accident. I think that what's probably going on here is that some Republican women are hearing these Trump comments, and they're not exactly liking them very much. And if you look at the favorable ratings for Trump, that's where you see a big disparity, where I believe the Suffolk poll that came out from Iowa yesterday had Trump's net favorability closer to plus 20 with men, while it was only about zero. That is, his favorable and unfavorable ratings were about the same among women. So it's pretty clear that he has hurt himself among women, but at this point he hasn't hurt himself enough that he's lost the lead yet in pretty much any of these polls.
What do we know about who's likely to go to the polls to vote in November, men or women?
Well, we know that if we're talking about a general election, women are more likely to vote than men are. It's a slight difference. You know, it depends on the exact election. It's usually like 52-48. In Republican primaries, it's more towards 50-50, and depending on which one you're looking at, males might be slightly more likely to vote in a Republican primary than women. But they're basically even across the board. So obviously, if you're Trump, you don't want to alienate yourself against at least half of the voting population. And if you're talking about the general election overall, women really don't like Trump, which is part of the reason why he runs the weakest among any of the Republicans in a matchup against Hillary Clinton.
Well, let's talk New Hampshire now. You mentioned that a little bit ago, and last week, or was it earlier this week, rather, you wrote that Bernie Sanders' surge is dying down, you said, but a new poll shows that he's leading now in New Hampshire for the first time. So what's your take on that?
My take is that I should no longer be a writer. No, I think that, you know, this is a great example whereby we have to wait for more polls to come in. Look, Bernie Sanders is from next door in Vermont. He does very well among white liberals. There are a lot of those in New Hampshire. There are a lot of those in Iowa as well, which is why his polling numbers in Iowa tend to run ahead of his national numbers. But this is just one poll. There were a lot of polls taken in July, a lot of polls taken in June. And what my piece was really getting at was if you looked at Bernie Sanders polling in June and July, and you looked at Hillary Clinton's polling in June and July, either nationally in Iowa or New Hampshire, those numbers were fairly steady, or in the case of Iowa, it seemed like Clinton was actually picking up a little bit of ground. And this poll just seems completely out of the blue in the sense that no other poll had Sanders leading, no other poll really had him close to leading, and pretty much all the conversation that I've spoken with other people who watch this stuff or may, you know, have some inside information, it's a real surprise. But again, who knows? It's a primary, things change, things shift. In late September of 1999, Bill Bradley, the liberal alternative, overtook Gore, only to fall back later. So it's just one poll, but it's something we keep an eye on. This is the reason we watch these things and let voters actually decide and choose and don't let analysts like myself tell voters what to do.
And Harry, briefly here as we wrap up, protesters from the Black Lives Matter movement have been showing up, interrupting Democratic rallies, Bernie Sanders in one case, talking with Hillary Clinton in another case. Are they having an impact on the conversation over on the Democratic side?
I think they're absolutely having an impact on the conversation. You know, we're talking a lot more about police tactics, police brutality, and black civil rights overall than I can remember in any recent primary. And more than that, that's part of the reason why someone like Bernie Sanders isn't doing well nationally is because his polling numbers with African Americans remain quite poor relative to Hillary Clinton's. And that's the sort of ace that she has in her back pocket.
Harry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week at this time for the latest in national politics. The John Doe investigation into whether Governor Walker's recall campaign illegally coordinated with outside political groups was halted by the state Supreme Court last month, but both sides in the case are still taking action in court.
The attorneys for the subjects of that probe are seeking to have a third party oversee the return of all the evidence collected during that investigation. Meanwhile, a prosecutor is considering trying to get the probe reviewed by the U.S. Supreme Court. The legal back and forth all along has largely been hidden from public view. Here to break down what we know is Jason Stein, state government reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Jason, good to have you back with us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So I summed it up a bit there. I mean, a lot of us, I think, thought that once that state Supreme Court thing came down, this John Doe probe was done in the courts. But there are still echoes and fallout going on. What kind of things are we seeing?
Well, so first of all, there's this immediate dispute about what to do with the evidence. As you said, you summed it up pretty well. The state Supreme Court said, look, prosecutors, you violated the constitutional rights of these targets, and you have to destroy everything, all this evidence that you gathered, and, you know, most of which we haven't seen. That presumably, though, has not yet taken place because the prosecutors have asked the state Supreme Court to consider its decision or reconsider its decision, and that is a hint that they're going to eventually appeal the decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. And you know what they're doing is setting that up by giving the state Supreme Court a chance to change its mind, which of course they won't do.
So, but the thinking is they need to get some time. If they destroy that evidence, any appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court anywhere else is going to have a real hard time if the evidence has all been returned or destroyed.
Well, right. I mean, I think it would be at that point, it would become pointless, right, because the basis that they would use for continuing their investigation would be gone. But presumably that would not take place because, I mean, again, the state Supreme Court has not replied to that request for reconsideration. And so, you know, presumably that'll all take place in a very deliberative way, and nothing, you know, no rash action would be taken until you get all the courts making their final determination.
So all this evidence that is supposed to be destroyed or returned to the people who are under mm-hmm. investigation here, well, a lot of it has been leaked. Do we know how much of it has been leaked? What do we know? What are the known unknowns here? If I can quote Rumsfeld, yeah.
That's very good, yes. We don't really know how much was gathered. We know that a lot was gathered. Certainly, we know that a number of subpoenas went out to a number of conservative organizations. Several of the targets have maintained that large amounts of information were gathered, you know, either in the form of paper documents or, you know, electronic records, so like phones. phones and hard drives and, you know, computers, other types of electronic devices. So all that is sitting out there. Again, some of it has been made public in these many lawsuits that have been filed over this in both state and federal court. But obviously there's still a lot of things that we don't know. And if there weren't, you know, if it were all public, I don't believe you would see this intense maneuvering over whether or not to destroy and return the evidence.
Talking to Jason Stein from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about the echoes of the John Doe 2 investigation. The investigation itself hasn't been on for a while, officially shut down by the state Supreme Court last month. It is not completely out of the courts yet, though. Now, Jason, we've been talking about the evidence. Also, conservative political groups who had been investigated have been talking about and challenging the way they were investigated. And we have cases in the court from the first John Doe probe. That's where we got some new information as recently as last week. What kind of things are they talking about from John Doe 2?
Well, and the conduct of the investigation and the evidence that's, you know, sitting right now behind seal are really linked up. And I'll give you an example of how. There are two different John Doe probes. The second one that was recently shut down by the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and the first one that was ended by Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm a few years back. And in that first Doe, there was a recently one of the targets, a woman by the name of Cindy Archer, who was never charged with anything, made some allegations in court that her rights had been violated by investigators, and gave a description that ended up in court documents of this pre-dawn raid on her home, and, you know, had a number of assertions about how that raid was conducted. And then we recently had the first John Doe judge released an audio tape recorded during that raid, and that audio tape did not contain on it all of the things that she had said had happened during that raid. And so after that tape was released, you saw the attorney for one of the John Doe 2 targets say, whoa, we want to make sure here that, you know, any recordings that may have been made of the raids on our clients' homes are not released into the public domain. And obviously in that second John Doe, again, you have the targets making claims about what happened to them during pre-dawn raids on their homes.
Now, we've been focusing so far on what the subjects of the John Doe probes are doing in the courts with the evidence and with the conduct of raids and things like that that you just mentioned. You also mentioned earlier the possibility of trying to get this thing into the U.S. Supreme Court, prosecutors trying to make this happen to, I guess, reopen the investigation. Where is that as far as procedure or timeline, as far as you know?
Well, so a couple of things. Number one, nothing is going to happen until the Wisconsin Supreme Court weighs in on this motion for reconsideration of its ruling. You know, once that happens, and there's no reason to think that the justices will change their mind, but once that happens, then the special prosecutor in the case, Fran Schmitz, will be able to decide whether or not to take that up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Again, he's not made public any decision, but the fact that he had asked for that reconsideration by the state Supreme Court suggests that that's where he's headed.
And what would they be asking the Supreme Court, in effect? Would they be asking them to overturn the decision made by the state Supreme Court here, or something else that would allow them to reopen the investigation?
Right. No, that's a good question. I think what it appears likely is that the special prosecutor had asked a couple justices to recuse themselves. Now, this is Wisconsin State Supreme Court justices, to recuse themselves from the second John Doe cases or multiple cases because the investigation dealt in part with conservative groups that had made independent spending on behalf of or in support of those justices on the court during their past elections. And so the special prosecutor had asked them to recuse themselves. They declined to do so or didn't do so. And so the most likely scenario is that the special prosecutor, if he appeals to the U.S. Supreme Court, will ask them to weigh in on whether or not those justices should have recused.
And as we wrap up, Jason, I imagine the tea leaves everyone is trying to read is, would the U.S. Supreme Court want to touch this case, and what would they do with it? What has anybody even been speculating on that yet?
Oh, sure. I mean, this is a state capitol, so we get lots of speculation about lots of things. But I think that the bottom line here is that, you know, there has been a case in the past, and I don't have all the details at my fingertips, where out east, at the level of a state Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court found that it is possible to have millions of dollars in spending, political type spending, that can create the appearance or the need, you know, the appearance of a conflict or the need for a state Supreme Court justice to accuse.
And we'll be watching for that, Jason. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, of course. My pleasure.
That's Jason Stein, state government reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Well, not to be a downer, but there's not that much of summer left to us. So if you're still working on your summertime to-do list, you don't have a lot of time to put it off any further.
I am in that category. One of my summer goals is to clean out the basement. Whoops, not there yet. So what gets us into this position in the first place? Why do we put things off? Why do we procrastinate? And can we change our ways? Our next guest has been researching procrastination for many years now. He's looked at the causes, the consequences, and possible cures.
Joseph Ferrari joins us now. He's a professor of psychology at DePaul University and the author of the book, Still Procrastinating, The No Regrets Guide to Getting It Done. Joe, thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Veronica and Rob. How are you?
Good, thanks.
I'm glad you picked this topic. If I may start, everybody procrastinates, but not everyone is a procrastinator. You know, it's not a time management issue. It's not a question of having a to-do list and having lots to do. Because busy people have to-do lists, why do they get things done? Why do some people, you know, there's that old expression, you want something done, give it to a busy person. Well, why? Because they value time, and they value the time of others. Procrastination is not a question of time.
So if it's not, then why? Why do we procrastinate?
Well, here we go. Everybody procrastinates. What we have found in my research here at DePaul since the late 1980s, I've been studying this topic, is 20 to 25% of adult men and women, there's no sex difference, are chronic procrastinators. This is their lifestyle. Their delay doing taxes and buying Christmas gifts, cleaning out the basement, Rob, doing restocking refrigerators, waiting the gauge goes on empty before they get more gas, paying the bill when the third bill comes. Why 20 to 25% individuals? And this is not just a U.S. phenomena. I have found this in Europe, in England, in Ireland, in Poland, in Italy, in Austria, in Israel, Tel Aviv, in the Middle East. We find it in Saudi Arabia. A graduate student just finished it in Japan. I've done South America, in Spain, Peru, Venezuela. 20 to 25%. That's higher than depression. That's higher than phobia. That's higher than many other psychiatric diseases. Substance abuse, addictions. And yet we take this as a funny topic. We look at this as, well, they're lazy. Well, they're just not getting things done. And that's not true, because procrastination is not dawdling, it's not delaying, it's not waiting. Because when you're waiting and dawdling and delaying, you're probably actively working on the task. You're gathering more information in.
Right, which brings me to the question, is there anything inherently wrong with procrastination? As long as you get the job done, what's wrong with procrastinating?
Okay, recent studies have shown, not from my lab, another lab, that you're three times more likely to die of a heart attack or a stroke. There's a whole field called behavioral economics that find that these people wait and lose tons of money in investing, never really gather resources, that companies will spend $10,000 a year per employee lost by procrastination. So financial, there's health, social relationships. As a social psychologist, my interest has been what impact does it have on our relationship with others. Procrastinators are not liked by other people. People don't like, even procs, I call them procs, don't like other procs. And where does this come from? Are we genetically born this way? Absolutely not. We're made this way. And where does it begin? In the family. And if we find that fathers, not mothers, make people procrastinators. Well, what kind of dad? The cold, demanding, stern father, as long as you live under this roof, is more likely to produce children that are likely to grow up to become procrastinators.
Wow.
Because this is how they learn to cope. What if it's a single home? Well, we also find if the mother or, you know, single parent is also that cold, demanding person, this is the way they the child learns to cope with life.
So
and they're not
a,
liked by other procs.
So, Joe, how does a parent train a kid to not be a procrastinator? What kind of setting do you need to give them to develop to not be a proc, as you call them?
Sure, you don't treat an 18-year-old like you treat an 8-year-old, and you don't treat a 28-year-old like an 18-year-old. And that's what we parents often do. They treat us the same. They're these cold, demanding, distant, unloving, inflexible. As children get older, you have to be flexible. You always love them. You never want people to hurt themselves. But sometimes we do have to let people learn to fail. That's one of the cures for procrastination. You have to let people stop bailing them out. Don't worry about the dishes piling up. So what if the car is stalled on the side of the road? They have to learn that life has consequences, right? I'm not saying let them hurt themselves. I'm saying let them learn that there's consequences for our life and stop bailing them out. It's called interpersonal dependence in psychology. They're very interpersonally dependent. They wait for others to do it for them. And then they'll say, but wait a minute, I was going to do that. Yeah, but you told me that 3 weeks ago. Someone had to pick the dining room table. We really needed the new car. The refrigerator had to be bought. All those kinds of things, you know. We really needed to go to this, see a movie. It was getting late. Yeah, you didn't like the one I chose, but someone had to make a decision, you know. So we have to let them experience life and stop bailing them out.
We're talking to Joe Ferrari right now, psychology professor at DePaul University and author of the book Still Procrastinating. So what's to be done about this, Joe? If we're made into procrastinators, maybe we know we've got a problem that sounds like us, but we don't know how to fix it because it seems almost insurmountable sometimes. Where do we start?
Okay, that's great, and everybody always wants the cures, but it's so important that we understand that these are not lazy people. To tell the chronic procrastinator just do it would be like saying to a clinically depressed person, cheer up. It's far more complicated, and that's not going to work. Now, if you're part of the 20 to 25%, let's be honest, you're going to need therapy. You need professional assistance because you've got to break the ways you think about it and the ways you act. It's not just a behavioral problem. It's not a time management issue. It's a perceptual thing. They're very concerned about what other people think about them. You see, if I never finish, I can never be judged by other people. I'd rather have other people think I lack effort than lacking ability, because lacking ability is far more detrimental to my image. So they put things off. So you've got to change and help reshape the way they think about the situation, and also learn new skills that allow them to finish. So if you're part of the 20%, you need therapy. The reason, Veronica, I wrote this book a number of years ago was I got tired of all the time management books that were out there and telling people, well, budget your time and learn to do this and break it down. And I kept getting calls and messages from people saying, this isn't working. There's more to it. What can you tell me as the international expert on this? And so that's why the title is called Still Procrastinating, because I'm trying to reach those people to say, you're still doing this with all these other approaches. Well, first of all, you're not alone. 20 to 25% is very high. So you're not alone. There's many people. And here's the profile that you fit. So I want people, your listeners, to learn, if you're a chronic proc, don't say, well, that's it, I'm doomed this way, it's in my genes, there's nothing I can do about it. Stop the excuse making, stop the buts and the howevers, and learn to start doing things. Just do it now, to take the Nike quote and extend it.
So your starting point, it sounds like, in therapy, or maybe if we're not in that chronic group, just occasional procrastinators, it's still a mindset change. So what has Absolutely. To change in the procrastinator's mindset to take those first steps?
Well, okay, some of these books out there like to talk about different types of procrastination. The data really doesn't show this. And by the way, there's an international group that studies procrastination. We just met in Germany back in July. We meet every 2 years. We're hoping to do the next one in Chicago. So that's hot off the press. But anyway. So what people are showing is that, this is not a time management. It has workplace implications, health implications, interpersonal relationships. If you're part of the 80% who may delay a task, well, step back and ask why. What's going on? What am I afraid of? This is all part of the way of rethinking. So what if I do it and it isn't 100%? A lot of procrastinators say, oh, I'm not a procrastinator. I'm a perfectionist, and until it's perfect, I don't want to hand it in. So I don't want to give it to you because it really isn't going to show my best work. Well, follow what clinicians call the 80% rule. If it's 80% done, if it's 80% accurate, that's good. If you want 85%, nothing is perfect. And don't use that as your excuse for not getting things done. Focus on getting most of it done. Notice I didn't say mediocrity. That's 50%. I'm saying, is most of it done? Is it vastly done? And if so, is this adequate for now?
I like that kind of thinking. We're talking about procrastination with Joe Ferrari. He's a psychology professor at DePaul University. He's authored the book, Still Procrastinating.
And you can join in with your questions and your experiences. Are you a chronic procrastinator, or is it someone close to you? How does it affect your life? Have you figured out how to get around your procrastinating tendencies and get things done sooner? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now with psychology professor Joseph Ferrari from DePaul University. He's the author of the book Still Procrastinating, The No Regrets Guide to Getting It Done. He's sharing his research on why we procrastinate and what we can do about it.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you procrastinate? Do you maybe need some advice? Have you figured out a way to not put things off? Call now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers right away. Joan is with us in Campbellsport. Joan, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Great topic.
What do you want to bring up, Joan?
I'm the biggest procrastinator around, and I know I am, but according to my boyfriend, major procrastinator. But I honestly will wait till the very last minute until push comes to shove, and then I'll tackle my task. But I have to be up against the wall.
And have you tried to fix that, Joan? Try to do something about it?
I do. I mean, I think about it, which I think is part of procrastinating too, but I don't know. Hmm. You know what I mean? But it's like I just know I have to do something, and I just can't. It's like I'm frozen. I just can't do it until I'm in a push comes to shove situation.
All right, and Joe, I imagine you hear this all the time. What do you tell people in that boat?
Absolutely, and in fact, we published a study to see, because you hear about this from a lot of procs. They say I have to wait till the last minute to get going. It's the only way I can get going. It jump starts me. So we did that. And Joan, what we found was, and I'm glad Rob asked you some follow ups about this, because you actually would do better. You would perform better. You would accomplish the task in more easily if you did it earlier. Now, this notion that I have to wait till the last minute to get going, actually, they failed. And we did this in experiments. This isn't just asking people. We actually brought them into the lab and put them under time limits and found that they do worse under the limited time. But they think they do better. So this waiting to the last minute to get myself going, getting the juices flowing, and I have to get motivated that way is really not accurate and not true. Now, true, we don't always fail, and they'll put, and I'm sure the procs listening to this will jump on and say, oh, he doesn't know. I remember that time when I waited and I succeeded. And then you have to say, yeah, but that was 23 years ago, and look at all the failures since. So, Joan, you know, you're not going to do the best job by waiting to the last minute. That's really, you're fooling yourself. And don't worry about not making the best possible job you can do. Do the best you can, and that's all we can ask. It doesn't have to be 100%.
Joan, thanks a lot for the call. And we're going to go next to Wanda joining us from Sheboygan. Hi, Wanda.
Hi. Yes, I have a problem with both sides. My son is a procrastinator. He's 23. My husband's always asking him to do stuff, and he can never get it done. So my husband is anal, so he just does it all the time, and then they fight, and it just drives me crazy. Do you have any solutions for that?
Great questions, Wanda. And Joe, what do you do when you've got conflicting personality styles going on?
Well, you notice what this sounds, what I said earlier. It sounds you've just given Wanda a great life example of the situation I said before. Your husband's bailing him out. Procrastinators are interpersonally dependent. They let other people do things for them if they wait long enough. And your husband loses it and says, I can't wait anymore. This has to get done. That has to get done. And then he does it. And then they fight because your husband angry, your son's going to come back and probably say, but I told you that I was going to do that, and it goes on and on. And I don't know, Wonder, if this is your personal situation, but the data shows moms tend to be more indecisive because the child will run to the parent and say, Mom, what am I supposed to do, Dad? And they'll say, well, I don't know, honey. He is your dad, and, you know, you should follow what he says. So you've got an interesting dynamic that sounds right up the alley. What can you do? Well, your husband's got to bite the bullet and let him fail. I'm sorry, he has to learn to fail. My Italian grandmother, Gwanda, had a saying, and it loses in the translation. For some people, they won't get out of the water till the they won't get off the beach till the water hits their behind. In other words, the tide is coming, and you can say to them, it's coming, you got to move. They won't move till they get wet. Your son's got to get wet, not drown. But your husband has to let the stuff on the beach get wet until your son says, hey, I got to move. All right? And some people have to know that. And you know who understands this, Rob and Wanda and Veronica? The 12-steppers. Because that's the model of the 12-step. You can't lead people to change. They have to bottom out. So Wanda, unfortunately, don't let him hurt himself, but your husband's got to let him get wet.
Wanda, good luck as we talk to Joe Ferrari about procrastination. He's a psychology professor at DePaul University. Back to our callers at 800-642-1234. George is with us in Fox Lake, Illinois. George, hi.
Hey, good topic. I'm also a therapist, and one of the things I noticed with folks who tend to prioritize is that there's a whether or not it's kind of capturing their life and making it difficult for them to move forward in areas compared to if they're just prioritizing. You know, I think a lot of times people prioritize, if we call it procrastination, but what they're really doing is saying what's important to them now, and they move forward in those areas and do what's important. Now, I think there's a difference between that and are you laying on the couch not doing anything productive in your life. But if you're replacing productivity in different areas, then I think it's prioritizing. And I just kind of want to know what your feelings on that as a psychology professor and what you sense in that area. And that's about it.
Joe, what do you think?
Thank you, George. A couple of quick comments. You're absolutely right, differentiating between prioritizing and procrastination. Look, if you've got a dozen things to do, obviously 10, 11, and 12 have to wait. Is that prioritizing? No. The true procrastinator makes that list of a dozen things, does one, maybe two, and then reshuffles the list and mixes it up and makes an extra copy of it and thinks about it and ponders it. Well, that's procrastination. You're absolutely right. These are not the same thing. So listeners who are, George, your clients out there who are realizing that they prioritize, you're not procrastinating. You're effectively working on tasks. There's a guy these days who talks about structured procrastination. He's really talking about prioritizing, but it's a catchy concept. You see, the problem, George, is I don't want your clients to realize that there's excuse-making here. Well, then it's okay that I can procrastinate, because they're looking for that opportunity. If we give them the out of it's a good thing and it's a positive thing and it's okay to procrastinate, well, then they're going to procrastinate. But life is too short, and as you know, we have to capture the gusto of all that's out there. Leave a legacy. Don't procrastinate. You know, life is not about me. Life is about we, and procrastinators have to understand that.
All right. Thanks, George. Let's get in one more quick call. Rebecca joins us in Oconto Falls. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. I actually trick myself, and my dad always says that I'm on Lombardi time because I'm a horrible procrastinator, but Lombardi said that if you're on time, you're late. So you're 15 minutes early for everything. So I actually trick myself that everything that I need done has a deadline, but I always put that deadline earlier. So if I get a party invitation and it's for 7 o'clock on my calendar, it goes for 6 p.m. Because then even if by chance I happen to be a little bit earlier, even though I'm always late for everything, I go around the block 2 times and then I'm on time.
That's smart, Rebecca. What about that, using some tricks like that to trick ourselves into being on time and getting things done?
Well, Rebecca, in other areas besides social events, do you procrastinate, or is it only when it comes to social events?
It's everything.
Okay, yeah. So if your boss said something has to get done, you procrastinate on that? Yes?
It's everything. It's schoolwork. It's, you know, even like if something needs to be filled out by this date. But I always, you know, put something, you know, my boss always laughs at me. He goes, you're always early on everything. And I'm like, well.
And Joe, just about 30 seconds for our response.
Okay, because it doesn't sound like you're a chronic procrastinator. The chronic procrastinator, the trick of setting the clock won't work. They know they have the extra time. If you do it for them and you trick them, because I've worked with clients to do that, they get really pissed. They don't like that. How dare you trick me? And now the element of trust. But if people who just procrastinate in one area of their life try to do that, that might work. And that's why I was trying to find that out, Rebecca. But if it works for you, super.
All right. Thanks a lot, Joe, for joining us today.
Thank you so much, and thanks for calling. And if you want to follow up so I don't have to talk a mile a minute the next time, let me know. We can make a longer show.
All right. That was Joseph Ferrari, professor of psychology at DePaul University, author of the book Still Procrastinating, The No Regrets Guide to Getting It Done. It is the end of an era in music history and a sign of the changing times, as the company that used to sell us 8 CDs or cassettes or 8 tracks for just 1 penny is calling it quits.
The parent company of Columbia House announced that it's going to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection this week, citing competition from music streaming services. The company's revenue was up over $1 billion in 1996 and went down to $17 million last year.
Now, this is a big part of my musical life as a kid, as a teenager, even into college, I think. So here's you had all these ads everywhere. You know, you get 8 or whatever cassettes or CDs, depending on what year you're talking about, for a penny. But then you're in the system and you have to check a box and send it back, say, no, don't send me the next CD, or they send it to you, you got to pay full price. So eventually they made money off of you. You got a lot of music up front, though, for just that 1 penny. So I got hooked in.
I did not, as someone who has trouble returning their library books on time. Thank God Joe Ferrari's no longer on the line. Yeah, this was not the thing for me, but other people did well by it.
It was a bad thing for procrastinators, definitely. Mm-hmm. Well, I can't remember what all I bought. I'm pretty sure I got my Cars Greatest Hit cassette from Columbia House. We'll go out to the news with the Cars here on Central Time.